I'm Christopher Lydon with Siddhartha Mukherjee, the medical doctor, cancer researcher, and biographer of disease in that breathtaking history of cancer that won the Pulitzer Prize last year called The Emperor of All Maladies. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Dr. Mukherjee, I thought we would pick up where the book ended around the cancer stem cell and the reverse engineering of it as sort of the cure of all cures. But then I discovered in a footnote in your book that you knew Tony Jutt, a diagnostician and a historian in a different realm. But it seems to me there's a connection. There's got to be one. And I'm dying to ask you about the work you did with him and then whether there is any sort of combination of your method and his cancer and this malaise, whatever we want to call it, that is in the land these days. Tell me about you and Tony Jutt.
Tony and I were friends for many years, and I learned a lot from him. Tony, as you know, was the preeminent historian of his time, particularly a historian of Europe. And he contacted me. He ran a thing called the Remarque Institute, named after Eric Maria Remarque. And it was a peculiar and a very important institution, which is that the institute would organize one meeting every year of people from all disciplines. And most importantly, it had no agenda. It would just ask some questions and it would have a conversation. No paper would be written at the end of it. And it was just a mechanism to begin to think, to start a series of conversations. And it was across the globe. And it was a very important part of my sort of intellectual life. What I shared most importantly with Tony was what I call the role of a benign skeptic. Tony was a skeptical historian. And I think we need people like that in all disciplines. People who can remain skeptics about received wisdom. You know, Tony's question about received wisdom was, why does Europe turn out to be where it is today? And his answer was, well, you know, you have to look to history to find the answers where we are today, and therefore it will tell you what to do next. In a sense, my connection with all of this is I ask the question, why are we here with cancer today? Or why are we here with another disease, let's say depression today? And if you take a skeptical look at it, you begin to solve a problem by breaking it down into pieces, but not forgetting that the pieces are related to each other. This is what Tony was particularly good at. So by examining in great skeptical detail any history, I think you can begin to find larger patterns at work. And I think that's the connection we share. That's the intellectual connection that we share.
Let me throw in a couple of small complications here. There's the whole matter of illness as a metaphor, right, as Susan Sontag said, but the way we think about it and your history of cancer is all about the radically different ways. Maybe something in the bile in medieval period, but then a kind of growth that could be cut out, then later radiated out, then later drugged out, or a genetic problem, a hormonal problem. In each case, it's becoming an entirely different thing. And then the further complication that in the Sunday Times magazine, you applied the same kind of reframing, renaming to the history of depression. Is it something in our childhood? Is it something in our blood? Is it something in brain chemistry? Is it something about neuron growth? What in the world does serotonin have to do with it? Each one of these transitions makes a big break. But Tony Jutt, in a certain way, was playing with the same method, like, what's going on here? What is Europe and how did it come? But then particularly, what is this state of the American mind right now? What notes did you compare in your years of talking with him?
Well, the notes that we compared were really about method. And by method, I mean, how does one go back and extract from the past the story of the past? And what does that story tell? I sometimes say that doctors are more obsessive historians than even historians. Because medical history, the medicine, not even medical history, the practice of medicine is a conversation with the past. Every time you open a medical paper, you're essentially speaking with someone who may or may not be still alive. And science has this capacity. It has the capacity of being a continuous conversation. It's probably one of the richest, most continuous conversations we've had in human history, because the terms have not changed so dramatically, such that even though the word depression has changed over the years, we know something about the way the word was used in 1890 and in 1990, and we'll know something about it, the connection between the words, in 2090. So I think that what we shared, most importantly, was this kind of obsession with the past, but not an obsession with the past as to curate the past, but an obsession with the past to understand mechanism. What is the mechanism of the past? What is the clockwork in the past? And why is that clockwork predicting what will happen in the future? Just to give you one concrete example, the theory of cancer has changed so dramatically, as you said, from bile to blood to local cancer to systemic disease, et cetera, et cetera. But that process, you have to understand that process to figure out what happens next. That pathway is dependent. It's crucial, because we would not have the genetic theory of cancer today if we didn't first at one point in time suspect that genes had something to do with it based on the fact that the other theories had failed. So there is this systematic elimination of things and a systematic changing of imagination. And we are interested in that kind of idea.
Well, in his case, and in Ill Fares the Land, he stops short and says, wait a minute, look at the history. We're letting go of a social democracy, of a sense that we're all in this thing together, that our prosperity is a constructed whole, etc., and we've got to work on that. And then at another level, he says, again, he sort of stops short and says, wait a sec, this polarization around money, the obsession with money, the training of students by the hundreds of thousands now, the most popular majors, all point them toward finance, which, you know, 300 years ago might have pointed them toward ministry or something. These are radical shifts, but that the condition today is not built into human nature. Again, there's something parallel to what you're doing in medicine.
One of the things that I and others are trying to do in medicine is to ask the question, is the current state of understanding of depression, say, or cancer, say, commensurate with what the biology is telling us? And if it's not, what conflicts need to be resolved so that we can move the field forward? Just to give you one example, the cancer stem cell hypothesis, right? So this is the idea that cancers contain stem cells. In other words, the reason, the theory runs, that the reason that when we get chemotherapy, the cancer melts away, but then it comes right back. And there are various reasons to explain why it comes back. For a while, we thought it was because the cells became resistant to the chemotherapy. And that's correct. They do. But now there is an additional layer. And we're wondering, our laboratory, others are wondering, whether the reason is that there is a repository within every cancer. There's a repository of cells that is specifically designed by evolution to form a kind of regenerative unit. Mm-hmm. And it will come back, like when you cut a tree off, the roots still persist and then the tree sprouts right back. Now, the problem is that you can have such a theory, but the theory then you need to create criteria by which the theory can be judged as correct or incorrect. Can we apply those same biological terms to understand cancer? So it's a very rich project, but it's a project that, again, has to do with medical history.
This was the note at the end of your book that so fascinated me. It left me, non-doctor, with this general notion of, I mean, we think of bone marrow stem cells that can reproduce almost everything from nothing, and it's the cancer stem cell is the evil twin. It's the other side that can reproduce chaos almost infinitely. You spoke of this persistent reservoir of cancer generating and regenerating cancer infinitely. So where does that take you? It at least gets you to the root of all the varieties of cancer. I'm intrigued at this is going in a different direction, but we know that there's a sort of exponential growth of understanding of and mapping of these cells. Can you take this one apart? Is that the project of the day?
Well, we have to be very careful about the cancer stem cell hypothesis, because as it turns out, if you look very carefully, some cancers do behave like this. So, for instance, leukemia, myelogenous leukemia, behaves like this in the sense that if you look at that cancer, leukemia, it behaves as if it has a compartment of such stem cells. What's interesting is other cancers don't behave like that. And we don't know why and why not. So, for instance, a good example is when scientists have looked very carefully at melanoma, for instance, it's very hard to prove that there's a stem cell-like cell. Every cell in some melanomas behaves like a stem cell. And in other melanomas, you can't find, you know, you have a hard time finding these kinds of cells. So there is a very dynamic debate going on as to understanding, you know, is this theory universalized or can it be universalized, or is it very specific to some cancers? Or could it be that even within breast cancer, there are some breast cancers that have stem cells? There are other breast cancers that don't have stem cells. So in other words, it's returning us back to the central question in cancer, which is, what is the degree of commonality across multiple forms of cancer, and what's the level of difference? And is the commonality significant enough that we should be beginning to think about this as, you know, something that we can therapeutically intervene on? Or is it so different that we have to subclassify even leukemia into those that contain stem cells and those that don't contain stem cells? So there's a very, very rich sort of evolving understanding just even of that idea. And it just reminds you that you cannot get caught up in the seduction of the idea. It sounds like a wonderful idea that, you know, the reason that cancers relapse, the next new wave of treatment is going to come from stem cell therapies, right? It sounds like a wonderful, seductive idea. But when you start looking at it more carefully, you find that even that idea has a kind of geographical specificity, has a kind of historical specificity. It's true for some cancers, not true for other cancers. Even within a cancer, it's true for some variants and not true for other variants. And now the task becomes, how do you discriminate one from the other? So, and that's where the richness lies. I mean, in biology, God is in the details. And if you don't provide the details, your theory will suffer.
Not in the magic bullet.
Precisely not in the magic bullet, yes.
I'm sure you know him better than I, but Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, the prophet of singularity, of a kind of convergence of biology and technology, says it's just a matter of time, and maybe a short time, at the growing rate of understanding these things, when we'll map it out.
I'm a little bit suspicious of this kind of lovely, glorious futures. My suspicion is that we will map out some of it, but a large part of it we won't map out. And by that I mean that we will learn to cure some cancers, we'll learn to treat some cancers, we'll learn to prevent some cancers, and some will remain challenges well into our future. You know, the singularity hypotheses are very seductive hypotheses. This is the kind of stuff that gets our brains going. You know, we have loved we are pattern seeking apes. We love these patterns, big singular patterns. And in general, they're true. There are some patterns that are common across cancer. But what cancer is telling us back is that a cell controls its growth through dozens of different mechanisms. A breast cell, a normal breast cell, controls its growth in response to dozens of different stimuli through dozens of different mechanisms. A skin cell controls its growth in response to a dozen different stimuli and using a dozen different processes. And therefore, when you disrupt the growth of a breast cell, it's somewhat different than disrupting the growth of a skin cell. And so therefore, what is applicable to a skin cancer may not be applicable to breast cancer. So if there is a central sort of conundrum that the field is facing today, it is this one. What is universal? What can be generalized? And what is not universal? Because these are very important distinctions. And if you overgeneralize, you'll be caught in this kind of black bile of 2012, which is a big magic bullet theory, a singularity, a prediction about the future. And when that future doesn't come about, you have disappointment and the nihilism that we've seen so many times over in cancer.
But what about the actual process of examining genes, breaking down the detailed structure of genes, even to the point of substituting, playing with them, repairing them, manipulating them? Is that a real prospect?
It's already a real prospect, yes. I mean, you know, cancer is a genetic disease. It is a disease that, really is caused by the abnormal regulation of genes. And therefore, there's much to be learned and is still being learned about breaking down the genes, finding the genes that cause cancer, etc. The problem probably, and people are suspecting this already, that knowledge will reach a kind of saturation point. And then you will require another transformative paradigm to come along and move us the next step. Now, that could be the cancer stem cell. So in other words, you've reached a place where you've understood the biology of cancer based on genetic understanding to a certain place. But now you require a next step. What is that next step? I don't know. Maybe the cancer stem cell. Maybe something to do with the microenvironment that the cells live in. Simple questions like, why is it that leukemia grows in the bone marrow but doesn't grow in your nose typically, right? What makes it? There's blood in your nose, but there's something very specific about the home of the cancer cell, the leukemia cell, that sits in the bone marrow. So I think, you know, that going back to, people have talked about this, famously Karl Popper talked about this, that there are evolutionary shifts and revolutionary shifts in all medicine, in all theories. And when the evolutionary shifts reach a kind of saturation point, you have to wait until there's really a transformative shift in paradigm.
I wanted to ask, How's the morale in the cancer fighting world these days? It goes through great waves, and suddenly the sun is out, and suddenly we're in a long sort of slow slog. Where are we?
I think the morale is optimistic, but is getting frustrated. You know, it's a mixture of optimism and frustration. It's like being in England in the summer when you see there's sunlight somewhere, but somehow it doesn't seem to break. And there's a sense that this rich information that we're getting about genetics, for instance, has got to transform itself into medicines or into ways to prevent or treat cancer. But where are those medicines? There's a very beautiful metaphor, actually used in my book, from Vannevar Bush, who says the boil of science creates a kind of steam. It finds its release in technology. Now, in the case of medicine, the boil of science, the steam of that boil, the technology that we're looking for is medicines, is drugs, or preventative mechanisms, right? But what's inside the field is the feeling that the boil of science, the steam is full, but the release has not been found yet. So you're being pushed at the edge of a kind of a pressurized can in which this information is coming at you. But where are the medicines?
Right. People feel the uncertainty too. You know, you and I did a book event last fall in which readers, literary folk, came to admire and applaud the amazing book you wrote, Emperor of All Maladies. And yet I also sense in that huge church, people desperate to know, Doctor, are you guys going to beat this thing that took my mother or my sister or it's been diagnosed in me? I mean, there was a kind of desperate urgency in
yes,
that crowd.
Absolutely. And you know, that urgency is I think we're all feeling that urgency. This conundrum, this problem has become one of the central driving problems of our society. Why are we here today, 35 years, 40 years after the so-called war on cancer, still, you know, locking our horns with this problem? Is it a systematic failure of imagination? Did we train too many bankers instead of taking that talent and putting it into, you know, solving cancer? Did we, were some parts overfunded? Is the pharmaceutical industry to blame? I mean, there is a massive public conversation going around on this idea. And of course, this is just a kernel, and it could be applied to mental health. It could be applied to HIV.
Exactly. Come back on that note to Tony Judt. I read Ill Fare as the Land, and I thought, my God, this is what we should be talking about. And it's a way of talking about a country in distress in an election year, and we're going to keep trying to use it as a kind of manual and a text. His process was to basically look at infinite variety of social symptoms and anger and division and analyses and people who think, you know, it's all about the Constitution or it's all about the national debt or it's all about rivalry with China or it's all about cutting taxes or raising taxes, and to sift through in a patient way to go for some underlying theory and framing that makes sense. How would you and he be talking about these methods and these problems together?
I think that's where Tony and I differ somewhat, or would differ somewhat. We've actually had this conversation in various forms through many years. Mm. You see, Tony is a great eliminator. He arrives at his theory and by the process of eliminating nonsense and finding what remains as sense. In fact, as you know, what he finds is he finds the answer already exists. You need to remove the nonsense to find the real answer. The answer already exists to reset the clock. That the answer exists it has existed in our past. We have found mechanisms to restore societies. And in fact, if we could only go back, we would find those mechanisms. I differ in the sense that I think, I believe less in elimination and more in innovation. I think the answer does not exist in many cases with some of these problems in the scientific realm. And in fact, the solution is to innovate to it. The solution is to innovate our way into the answer. Unfortunately, I believe that if the country is facing perhaps a moral crisis in the political realm, I think we're facing an innovation crisis in the scientific realm. And by that, I mean we don't even know how to train minds, or we're beginning to forget how to train minds that's going to solve our way out of the problem. That's what worries me. I think the answer doesn't exist. For Tony, the answer existed, but it was covered. For me, the answer doesn't even exist, so it can't be uncovered by eliminating the parts that are not reasonable.
That criticism sounds right about Tony Judt. There was something of nostalgia in his book. He thought that social democracy, as it had evolved in Europe in the 20th century, was basically what we needed.
Yes.
And he worshipped trains
yes.
as a kind of metaphor, but also an aesthetic, a way, as Tim Snyder said, of being alone together and yes. together alone. We're free to wander up and down the car. We're by ourselves, but we're in a context and we're going to the same place kind of thing.
Let me tell you a story that might be interesting to you. So I took a remarkable trip with Tony to Vienna.
By train?
No, not by train. Well, actually, I guess we arrived by plane. But then we went into the city and Tony gave me an amazing tour through the city. But one of the things that was amazing about him is that not only did he know all the roads that went in and out of the city, he knew all the routes. What train went into the city at what point of time, this was part of his sort of vocabulary. So the next day, I took Tony on my tour of Vienna, which is actually a tour that starts off in what is now the Freud Museum and moves all the way up to the Allgemeine Krankenhaus, behind which is the famous circular madhouse where the mentally ill were placed in the 19th century. So it was a reminder of the fact that the very same city can have so many different geographies to so many different people. And for Tony, the geography was the geography of the transportation system as a metaphor for what had happened or hadn't happened in Europe. For me, the geography was the geography of the history of medicine, starting from Freud, or actually starting from the mental hospital with its destabilizing circular architecture and ending up in Freud's couch in Vienna.
Come back to how you and Tony would talk about analyzing and weeding out and treating the afflictions that we worry about today.
One kind of question that I think both of us were, it's so funny using the word past tense, but I suppose that has to be done. But one kind of question that both of us were interested in is, are there, what might call in biology or in medicine, are there common final pathways? So let me give you an example of this idea. And it's a very important idea. So you might say that there's a diverse series of causes that causes a heart attack, right? But in the end, a heart attack proceeds through a common final pathway. There has to be a clot inside the coronary artery, which is causing a heart attack. So regardless of whether you got a heart attack because you have a family history or because you happen to eat the wrong kind of food, it proceeds through a common final pathway. And yet there are other instances of illnesses which don't proceed through final common pathways. And you can imagine that they're rare, that the geography, the architecture of systems, human systems, whether they be biological systems, whether they be federal systems, these systems may differ. Some of them might move through these nodes, as it were. So one of the things that I think both he and I were very interested in the idea is, what are the nodes? Are there such nodes? And if there are such nodes, can they be intervened upon? So for Tony, for instance, to give you a very concrete example, there was a common final pathway of moral degeneration in politics. He claimed that there was a common final pathway. And this was his diagnostic realm, and his intervention was ill fares the land. In other words, he said that the collapse of social democracy in the United States was the final common pathway through which we could understand how we might, number one, diagnose and potentially treat the ills of the future. This was his hypothesis.
Yeah.
And he was a great eliminator. He eliminated all the other possibilities, and he landed up with this one, and he was convinced that was the cause of the rot, that was the cause of the error. In a historical brain, the kind of almost proverbial scientific method at work, you know, is there a pathway? Is there a clot in the system which is causing this kind of crisis? Or could it be that it's death by a million cuts, which is the opposite, right? So there is no common final pathway, but in fact the reason that we're corroding is because, you know, Medicare is exploding on one hand, and your children are watching too much television on the other, and because we can't solve the segregation crisis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is sort of the death by a thousand cuts system. Tony didn't believe that. He did not believe the death by a thousand cuts was the problem in America. He believed that, in fact, you could organize history into these nodes.
Right.
And that these nodes, that if you intervened on these particular nodes, that you could change the course of the future. That's a very, very different kind of thinking. It is a kind of thinking that brings up an incredibly polemic conversation. Because you and I might not be. It's very easy to argue around the kind of what I call the death by a thousand cuts hypothesis. You say, well, it's these, you know, these are the problems. I say these are the problems. We can argue ourselves into the blue moon. But if you put yourself down and you say the central common final pathway is a corrosion of society in America, the corrosion of a social contract, you are putting your money into a single theory that can be proved or disproved, argued around and argued about. And that was the kind of conviction, I think, that, you know, that very scientific conviction in a historian.
Right. It's very powerful. I like your phrase that he believed you could reset the clock to something like the London that he grew up in,
yes,
where public services abounded. He had a free path through education from a sort of lower middle class Eastern European Jewish upbringing into Oxford and then NYU and all sorts of other things. And then he also put a huge emphasis on rescuing the public conversation.
Yes.
A public forum, and in that Orwell sense of a degraded public language is a symptom of a degraded public life and politics.
But where, I mean, this is, and this gets back to our central conflict, which, as I said, we talked about. But where was scientific entrepreneurship in that?
I was just going to ask.
Well, in that system, with many public services, the trains ran on time. They brought you to the university that was paid for by public taxation. When you fell off the train and broke your bone, you would be taken to a hospital and paid for through public resources. But it is a peculiarity that, and this was the question that we came back to many times. It was a peculiarity that scientific entrepreneurship did not happen in that site. Did not really happen in that site. And why not? Was it because that the public landscape had taken away something about entrepreneurship itself? Had it sapped some energy that had moved for historical reasons to the United States or could not be fostered in that system, which was so systematic? Was there enough space for real dissent? And I don't mean revolutionary dissent. I don't mean sort of, but I mean the kind of dissent of theoretical dissent, and that remains a big challenge. I mean, this is the question that we wrestled with for really 5 years.
It's so interesting. There's no reset button in medicine. You can't go back to anything in the 19th century or the 20th century either, and you don't want to. But make the case of how you would apply a sort of innovative, oppositionist kind of disruptive repair in the body politic.
I think the question is beyond me. I mean, with all humility, I mean, this is Tony's realm.
But no, you say you're an innovator, and you believe we've got to innovate our way out of medical and other problems. How would you apply that to, you know, the social torpor or confusion or fear, anxiety about who we are, where we're going?
Well, I think part of the answer is we have to innovate our way out of that too. I mean, you know, just a good example of this is a kind of what I call a kind of psychic innovation. Take, for instance, the so-called immigration crisis, right? I think that it's a reminder that we need a psychic innovation out of that crisis. This is historically a nation founded on immigration.
Right.
The fact that in 2012, the founding force is a crisis in Arizona, say, is a peculiar twist of human history. And I think the answer to this is, for me, speaking as someone who is interested in innovation and entrepreneurship, is to figure out there must be an innovative way, there must be an entrepreneurial way to think about immigration and restore the kind of innovative entrepreneurial spirit that made immigration such a positive force in the 18th century, in the 19th century. What is that force? What is that way? There must be a political solution that allows this force of young minds that is desperately trying to get into this country and converting that and decreasing the torpor that you know you and I are talking about. It's an innovation problem. So I think Americans are particularly good at social innovation. And one of the things that is surprising is that is particularly today, to me, that's surprising is that we have a simultaneous complaint that we're having social torpor, but not having social innovation. Those two things are very peculiar. That's a peculiar sort of rift in my understanding of what I know about this country. I came here as an outsider, and I continue to be amazed at the quality of social innovation. This country made society plastic. It made it elastic. And why is it that we are now having a debate about whether we are, suffering from some kind of torpor when in history, you took society and molded it in a different image?
Your friend Atul Gawande has written about that in The New Yorker, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes.
In agricultural policy in the past, and the room for exactly the same kind of social innovation under the new Obamacare. Can you give concrete examples of where you'd begin? Locally, grand scale? What would it look like? And what pieces of the social map would you be touching?
Well, one that's particularly near and dear to my heart is medicine, medical care. Now we're talking about healthcare. It seems to me that the kind of solutions that we're coming up with the healthcare crisis are eliminative solutions. Going back to this discrimination that I was applying before, which is, let's eliminate things and let's try to go back to the National Health Service of the United Kingdom and we'll get the right solution. Or someone is saying, well, let's eliminate everything else. Let's go back to the Canadian system and we'll have something else. What I'm interested in is not the Canadian system. I'm not interested in the United Kingdom system. What I'm interested in is a system which is completely innovative, which incorporates the best of some of these systems, but makes it specific for this country with its highly heterogeneous population, with its highly complex groups of individuals. Mm. So, for instance, could there be a private-public system in which you have a mixture such that insurance, for instance, kicks in when you have true catastrophes in the way that insurance is supposed to kick in, and that is managed publicly. Whereas other things which are not catastrophic, you may pay in for. So there's a kind of a melding of the private public, and it would be unique and innovative and unique for this. I'm not the only person to talk about this. These are not my ideas. I'm echoing some of the innovations that people have been proposing, which do not bring the United States, do not make the United States a mega United Kingdom or a mega Canadian system, but are unique to the needs and the specificities of this country.
That's an interesting difference. In education, say, the Tony Jett reflex might well be to say, look to your land-grant history, public institutions, beef them up again, rebuild the California system. What would the Atul Gawande, innovate your way out in a 21st century, all-American, future-minded way?
Incorporate social media. Social media has been invented since that time. How does that make its way into public education? What is the role of technology in public education? What is the role, for instance, a good example, there's a big question mark about how to deal with teachers who don't measure up to quality standards. And the mechanisms that are being proposed to police this system are mechanisms that really date back to the 19th century, which include things like testing the teachers on standardized tests, for instance, or figuring out whether the children are performing well on standardized tests. These are extremely, to me, relatively primeval methods. These are 19th century methods applied to a 20th century problem, 21st century problem, right? So there may be, and I'm sure there are, innovative ways of thinking about how to eliminate teachers who are not performing, which don't have to do with this kind of standardized testing model, which have to do, for instance, with incorporating social media. Children are heavily intersecting with social media. Is there information, is there data that can be mined from that intelligently, such that we can predict who's performing well, who's not performing well, in a more textured way?
Hmm. Innovate your way out of the debt problem. Would the Mukherjee instinct be to start with a grand forgiveness of debt, a debt jubilee, burn it and start again, or what?
Well, generally, as you know, it's an important point about innovation, I think. You don't burn your way into new innovations. Generally, the history of innovations in the sciences involve a deep respect for history. Innovators are are, much like people in medicine and science, innovators are historians first before they become innovators. Mm-hmm. They look to the past to move to the future. So I don't think that the solution would be to, you know, a burn your debt day in which you throw all your debt to the burners. But the solution might be, using the kind of methods we've been talking about, find the nodes. Are there common final pathways? Are there nodes which are responsible for the current debt crisis? And if one can diagnose those nodes, can one move beyond them? Are there some that are chronic? Are there some that are acute? What is the acuity? When has the acuity come about? So long before the land fares ill, you have to find what the geography of the land is. And in this case, we don't even know the geography. Give us the information, provide us the information, and we'll be able to kind of begin to solve it. So I don't believe in these kind of magical solutions, but what I do believe in is a skeptical diagnostic equilibrium, as it were, that allows us to then move forward.
Two last questions for me. In the Mukherjee view, how fares the land? Big picture. Are you a little less dire than Tony Judd?
I am a little less dire than Tony. My general feeling is that he was absolutely spot on in recognizing the malaise. I disagree with the treatment. The malaise is that there has been a collapse of multiple things in our public conversation. It is not clear to me that the return to England of the 1970s, that's oversimplifying what Tony wants to do. That's making a straw man out of him. But in essence, I don't think returning to a public system is the complete solution for the United States.
Last question. Take a guess. Assume it's Romney and Obama in the final campaign. What do you suppose will the choice be that people are offered? And how would you frame it if you could? What should we be choosing between in this final contest?
I think we should be choosing between a true innovator and someone who does not know how to innovate. I don't know. I don't even know the answer yet, because this answer will evolve. But it is clear to me that we require someone who can preside over a decade of innovation. And by that, I mean social innovation, political innovation, economic innovation, because our engines are running slow. Our engines are running dry. So I think we need someone who can convince us that they have the capacity to cool everything else off and heat up the, you know, pour that energy into an innovative generation. Who is that? I don't know. But what they need, to my mind, what they need to do is to say everything else is largely irrelevant. There are major problems, and the solution is to have an incredible engine of innovation. How do we do that? How do we best optimize this? How do we silence all the distractions and then put all the energy into this kind of social innovation around healthcare, around debt, around the economy, so that the conversations become real?
I wonder if you're describing a program for India, too.
I am. I mean, you know, I recently took a trip to Delhi, and you feel the energy. You feel that energy. Yeah. You used to feel that. I mean, maybe you still do. When you went to California in the 1990s, you got off the plane and you felt the energy. You get off the plane in Bangalore and you feel the energy. It may be wrong energy. But, you know, India has many, many problems. Let me not paint an overly rosy picture of it. But you feel the energy, and the energy is the solution.
I have a friend in Bangalore who, roughly speaking, gave 100 cameras to 100 kids and said, go out and each of you interview 100 people. And the question is, dream India, invent it with new technology, social media. We're going to throw 10,000 wild dreams of India into the air and sort of see what sticks. But I know exactly what you mean about that energy. How's to import it? How's to grab it?
Well, I mean, I think the energy came from here. So, I mean, you know, you just have to use Tony's method. You have to eliminate all the other nonsense. And get it back. This is the source of the energy.
Hugely fascinating. Siddhartha Mukherjee, thank you so much. This conversation went in all sorts of different directions that I hadn't anticipated a week ago. But I'm so grateful to you for playing the game with us and really opening up a new vista.
Well, thank you so much. As you know, it's not a game.